Recording of a cassette made at home by Mr. R.H. Earnshaw, which will be given the number 965 if we use it, about his experiences in the Russia just after the First World War.
Well, I was talking to someone the other day about my visit with the army to North Russia in the autumn of 1918 and up to about July 1919. It was suggested that it might be a good thing if I were to write a few notes on the subject. I'm afraid that to write anything in the nature of a book is not in my scope, but I have thought that I might make a few remarks on tape so that anyone interested in the future would be able to have some idea of what conditions were like and what sort of fun and games we had there. I suppose it is the best thing to begin at the beginning. I joined the army in 1915 when I was 16 years and 5 months old and went out to France early in 1916, and after 2.5 years more or less there came home for a tour of duty in England, which after soldiering in France didn't measure up very well to my ideas of what I like doing. So I volunteered, first of all, for a draft to Mesopotamia, and then that was cancelled, and so shortly after that, I volunteered for another draft to go to Russia. At the time, we had no idea where we were going to in Russia. Some said it was to Vladivostok, others to Archangel. Ultimately, it proved to be Archangel. First of all, I perhaps ought to say a few words as to why we were there at all. In the latter part of 1917, I think, the Russian front had collapsed, and it was suggested that the Germans were taking submarines in parts up to Murmansk, assembling them there, and then putting them out into the Atlantic to attack British shipping. It was, of course, vital that this should be stopped, and British and Allied forces were sent to Murmansk. Certain Russians were favorably disposed and helped us. Then, when the situation straightened out there, it was felt that we could not come out and leave them on their own, or they would undoubtedly have been murdered or something of that sort. That was one story. Another was that although a British force in North Russia could not do much from a military point of view, it would at least draw away some strength from the Western Front, which was in a very sorry state before the Americans arrived in full force, and that was another reason put forward, which was the proper reason, I really don't know. However, whatever it was, we were formed up. Quite a reasonable force was sent there. My unit was sent from Borden Camp to Dundee. We entrained first thing in the morning, took the whole day getting to Dundee, and arrived there in the small hours of the following morning, and embarked on a vessel called the Porto of Oporto. She was an ex-German ship and sailed in a party of three, the other two ships of the party being the Stephen, which I later had learned was a Bull Line vessel, and the Clan MacRae of the Clan Line. We were a passenger come cargo vessel, although, so far as I am aware, all the cargo holds were converted for troop carrying, but both Stephen and the Clan McRae, to the best of my knowledge, were simply full of war stores. The voyage to Archangel was uneventful, apart from seasickness, to many, in fact, more or less all of us. The first day out, one rather funny incident was that the sick parade on the day after we had sailed went before the MO. Fortunately, I had got rid of all my trouble prior to this, but those who went told that the MO was sitting in front of a table with his head in his hands. He said to them, "What is your trouble?" They replied, "I'm seasick, sir," and all they got from him was, "So am I." That's part of army life. I, being a Lance Corporal, was made NCO in charge of deck sweepers. I was only about 18, and the deck sweepers, I think there were 12 of them, were mostly men old enough to be my father, so you can guess it wasn't a very easy job. I tried for some occasions. We had to sweep the decks two or three times a day. I tried on two or three occasions to get them on with the job. Then, when I found I was flogging a dead horse, I got them all along to the lamp trimmer's locker where the brooms were stored, doled out the brooms to them, told them to get on with it, and I spent my time yarning with the lamp trimmer, and he taught me how to splice. And I suppose I kept him supplied with tobacco. Another rather funny incident was, again, being a Lance Corporal, I was NCO in charge of one of the mess tables. These were tables seating perhaps a couple of dozen men. I sat at the end nearest the gangway, and of course, being a perfect little gentleman, first meal we had, I passed the Dixie of whatever it was along round the table, meaning to get my share last. But when it came to me, there was nothing left. Consequently, in future, I cut out being a gentleman and served myself and then let the Dixie go round to the rest. The sleeping accommodation was down the hatches, which had staircases rigged into them, and then there were hooks up in the, what one might term the ceiling, on which we slung hammocks, and that was our accommodation for the voyage out. This took about a week, and it was quite interesting. Not that there was anything very much to do. Our time was spent mostly on deck singing songs. Then we had a concert or two at night and that sort of thing. It was there I learned to smoke thick tobacco. The only tobacco to be had on the ship was Plug, Faithful Lover and Fair Maid, which was like cutting... It had to be cut off the plug with a knife, and it was like cutting off a piece of wood. Then one rolled it in the palm of the hand so as to make it suitable for smoking. Quite an accomplishment, but once you got into the idea, it was not too difficult. Archangel is possibly 6 or more miles up the river Dvina, and the whole of the area round there, I suppose, is really a huge delta, but a passage for ships, a sort of a canal, had been made with sawmills on either bank, and the wharfs were made by offcuts of the timber, that is the outside bark and so on, which was stacked up, making a banking at which a ship could tie up and load the sawn timber, pick props, or whatever was to be taken. However, this was just a passing interest. We went up to Archangel, where we saw a British warship anchored. I think it was the Warspite. Then, farther up again, to a place called Bakaritsa, on the opposite bank of the river. Archangel is on the north bank of the river, and Bakaritsa is on the south bank, and just like the Mersey, the river widens out very considerably higher up, and this place, Bakaritsa, might be, farther up than New Ferry, but the same idea, 2 or 3 miles, at least 2 or 3 miles, beyond Archangel. And there was the port, which was converted into the Ordnance Depot. We arrived there about the middle of September, and were busy for a matter of 6 or 8 weeks, clearing cargo which was being landed from steamers and storing it into the warehouses. But once the winter weather set in, about the middle of November, it snowed until, well, possibly the end of the year. I don't remember in particular. After that, we had very little snow in the way of snowfalls, but a continuous frost the whole time, right away through until the thaw in the following April. The army was, of course, equipped with special clothing and gloves. We had leather jerkins, woolen cardigans, a sort of waterproof overcoat, fleece-lined, which was quite good, 3 pairs of gloves, 1 pair of ordinary woolen gloves, 1 pair of index finger woolen gloves, and finally 1 pair of what we call Arctic gloves, which were the sort of thing that you do see Arctic explorers wearing. They were just a mitten, a glove on either end of a length of tape, or what appeared to be like lamp wick, which we threaded through up one sleeve and down another, so that you didn't lose them. And it was, in the middle of winter, necessary to wear all 3 pairs at once. The coldest I remember was 40 below zero, and that's getting down a bit. My particular job was superintending the traffic as it came up from the ships in railway trucks and sorting it out into the various stores. As you will appreciate, the ordnance supplies pretty well all the army needs, apart from medical supplies, foodstuff, and horses, so that we had all the everyday things in the way of clothing, knives and forks, camp equipment, carts, guns, items too numerous to mention. Even ammunition is an ordnance supply, but that was with a different section, and it was something of which I had nothing to do in general terms. As I said, during the few weeks before the freeze-up, we had a very busy time sorting the stuff out into the various sheds. Then, when the freeze-up began, there were no ships, or at any rate a very limited number, got through in the early days. Things slackened off, and we were sorting out the stuff that had been left behind by the Russian forces prior to the collapse of the Russian army. I really cannot remember everything that happened, but I know we were kept going all along. The British personnel were in charge of the operations, but the bulk of the labour, particularly transport, was done by the Russians. Poor folks, I don't think we should have got them to work for us for payment of money, because money had little or no value if there was nothing to buy with it. But they were paid in what was called Kerensky money. That was money issued by the Kerensky government, but guaranteed by the British. And then it was part of the agreement that the labourers in the warehouses, the sleigh and carts that are called droskies, drivers, were paid or permitted to buy food at military warehouses in exchange for the money which they had been paid. Also, they were able to buy a degree of better food, oats, etc., for their horses. They were lovely little ponies, only quite small by our standards, more like ponies than horses, but the condition they were in when they started working for us was very poor, as their diet for long enough had probably not been anything more than grass or hay. But once they got giving them oats a bit of good grooming, they really looked splendid little animals. They were not, of course, able to pull anything like the loads that a big British Shire horse would do. The roadways were all wooden sleeper tracks. That didn't make the movement of a cart or a drosky too easy. Then when the snow came down, they were of course working on snow covered roads, and eventually instead of having the wheeled vehicles, they drew sleighs, the very roughly constructed thing, one might think constructed by local carpenters, but anyhow they did the job, and could be loaded to amount of, I forget really what it was, but a punt, I think was the word, which was about 36 English pounds, and the most you could load onto a sleigh for any journey was about 16 funts. So you see, a sleigh would carry less than 10 hundredweights. The people that we had working in the depot were a very mixed lot, being refugees from other parts of Russia. For example, it was said, with what truth I don't know, that the old man who sold newspapers was a count, and quite a number of the people working as labourers in the warehouses had gold-filled teeth, which you couldn't imagine was a normal way of life for the Russian peasantry of those days. And they were a funny lot in many respects, and yet in other ways quite good. For example, one of the strange things that happens, of course, you will understand, we had to work through an interpreter to a great extent, although most of the troops did learn an amount of Russian, elementary, just enough to get by. However, one of the funny things which happened was, when we had a fall of snow, I was told to tell off the labour, some to clear the newly fallen snow around the warehouse so as to facilitate the movement of the fire engine in the event of fire. Everything being built of wood, it was very necessary that we took careful fire precautions. The other part of my labour was to load ammunition. So I thought, well, the fairest thing to do with a job like this is put the men on the ammunition and the women on the snow shifting, which was quite a light job because it was newly fallen snow, and the shovels provided for snow moving were quite easy things to use. They were long sticks, like a long broomstick, with a plate of plywood at the end, and the plywood was sheathed with a tin strip at the edge so that it wouldn't break away, and as you can imagine, moving snow with these was quite a comfortable job. But the women refused to do it. Therefore, the only thing I could do was to get hold of the interpreter, explain my situation to him, and ask him what about it. He said, you don't understand. Snow moving is a thing that is only done by the poorest people in Russia. And a lot of these women which you have working for you are quite good class women, but they have to work to make a living under these conditions. So I soon solved that problem. I got them all together and said, some of you have to do the snow shifting and some of you two have to do the ammunition moving. Choose which job you want. I got a team for each, a lot of the women preferring to hump cases of ammunition weighing 60, 70, 80 pounds rather than move light snow. However, those are the sort of funny problems we had to overcome. Another rather queer incident was I had goodness knows how many coils of barbed wire which were stowed in the open and being snow covered, and I had to get them out of the snow and put into warehouse. Naturally, handling barbed wire was not a very pleasant job, and particularly for people who had a very limited supply of gloves, etc. So what I did was to get a supply of army gloves for them and some short iron rods which they could place into the spindle of the bobbin, not the spindle, the hole of the bobbin on which the barbed wire was wound, and it made it fairly comfortable to handle. Even so, I didn't get a great deal of progress, and at the end of the day there were complaints that we were not moving this stuff quickly enough. Therefore, I said to my sergeant in charge, will you leave me to get the job done, and I think I know how to tackle it. Yes, he said, if you can get it done, get on with it. So I call all my Russian crew together, and I said, we only moved 200 or 300 coils of wire yesterday, which is not enough. Now we've got 600 or 700 coils to move today. It's up to you. You get on with it, finish the job, and then you can go home. This they did, and they all went home about 3 or 4 o'clock, which was a great improvement on our previous day's work. It must, of course, be borne in mind that weather conditions did make things difficult. For example, we were all told that we should not think of picking up metal things, nails and nuts and bolts or anything of that sort, without gloves on, because if we did so, they would stick to our hands and simply tear the skin away when we were pulling them from our hands. I have mentioned the gloves and the coats with which we were supplied, but I also should mention that we had some boots which were called Shackleton boots, and it was said were used by the Shackleton Antarctic Expedition, and Shackleton actually was in Archangel as clothing advisor. These were a woolly inside with a white canvas outside, not laced as ordinary shoes are, but had two thick white tapes which were just wound round our ankles and then tied. There was no lacing up of the boot. The soles were polished leather, perhaps more or less half an inch thick, and seemed a very good thing. but as polished sole unto a polished road, icy road, was not exactly the best way of keeping on your feet. The men were more often on the behinds than on their feet until we got into the way of nailing little strips of felt across the sole of the shoe. But again, this was not altogether good, as these were stitched and not nailed so as to avoid any cold getting into the feet. However, I was fortunate enough in getting a pair of Russian boots. I really don't know how I got them. Anyhow, they were made of felt, moulded, like a Wellington, but in felt about a quarter of an inch thick, and were called the Linky. Now, these were as warm as a toast. You moulded them to the shape of your feet, and there was not a right and a left until you'd made them so by usage. But after I'd been wearing these for Linky for 3 or 4 days, they gradually began to get less and less efficient at keeping my feet warm, until I spoke to an interpreter about this, and he said, "Are you thawing them out each night?" I said, "No." Well, he said, "You must stand them not against the stove, but close to it, because all day long, particles of ice are being padded into the felt and eventually, of course, are going through. Whereas if you thaw them out each night by the fire, everything will be warmer, as it was." Another interesting thing was, during the period when it was beginning to get cold, we were issued with balaclava helmets, which we turned up into sort of bonnets, not pulling them down over our chins, and in addition we had a fur hat, fur lined with ear flaps, which none of the chaps would wear because they thought it was very sissy to wear a thing like this. They were beautiful, well, nice fur, I suppose it was rabbit or some such skin inside, and white cloth outside. But, and as I say, nobody would wear them. But I was out on one occasion doing outside work, and I with a balaclava helmet on me, and I really began to feel lightheaded. I suppose my brains were beginning to freeze. However, I put my hands on my head and warmed myself, and I went normal again, and very quickly went back to barracks and began wearing my fur cap, and after that, fellows in general took to them. It really was necessary to wear this special clothing so as to keep warm under the conditions. One journey I had in the winter time was to go